The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyon.
All right, so listen, everybody, I appreciate those that keep coming to these spaces. I'm going to give a little warning ahead of time. I'm fighting through some kind of a cold bug or something, so if I sound a little different than usual, it's not because I'm getting choked up over oil. It's just because I'm a little bit off, but I'm powering through here. My name is Michael Guyon, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour here is Rory Johnston of CommodityContext.com. Rory's been a great communicator in the space, has a unique way of looking at the commodity space, and apparently is a hell of a barbecue chef, so to speak. So we'll maybe get into that a little bit. But Roy, for those who are not familiar with your background, talk about who you are. How'd you get interested in the commodity space and oil in particular? And what are you doing with Commodity Context?
Thanks so much for having me on, Michael. My background is I worked at Scotiabank in Toronto in the economics group for 6 or 7 years. And when I left, I was leading commodity economics research there. So given the focus of Scotiabank, it was mostly kind of Western Canadian oil and gas and metals and mining in Latin America. So that's kind of my main background, although by the bulk of my time and kind of passion energy, has mostly gone into the oil space. So I've been kind of following oil for the better part of a decade now, writing about it for just about as long. I've seen a bunch of the kind of structural shifts and breaks in the market. And I think what's fascinating is that we're kind of seeing as many kind of changing regimes in the past 2 years as I saw in the previous 10. So it's been quite exciting and kind of a thrill to kind of keep up with what's going on. But I think everyone has kind of gotten various points of this kind of trade wrong, just because of how bizarre the environment is. You've got, structural undersupply, plunging inventories, draining open interest in the major futures contracts because of the volatility. You've got, major geopolitical disruptions, kind of everything happening all at once. And as I often tell people when I'm talking about this, that, for the majority of my career, when analysts got together and debated the view, it would kind of be 500,000 barrels a day here, maybe 1 million barrels a day on either side. That was the kind of scope of disagreement. Now, each major line item in the global supply demand, balance models are, they have error bands of, 1 to 2 million barrels a piece for, Russian production, for U.S. shale outlook, for the Saudi kind of capacity response function, Chinese demand, given what's happening with COVID, and then global demand, given all of the macro risks we face. So it's a very, very interesting time, but I think it's a time that's very, very difficult to have a base case view because you're going to need to take a discretionary, view on at least one or two or three of those major factors. So that's why I think there's so much diversity in view right now, is that it's very, very easy to, it's easy to construct a scenario where crude goes to 200. It's also not impossible to create a scenario where crude goes to 65. And I think that's what makes this so interesting and why the volatility is so extreme. And I think why the passions and emotions I see on my timeline are kind of so inflamed, even relative to the norm, which is already a fairly emotional space. So I think it's just a fascinating time to be in the market.
Yeah, so I love that point that you emphasize, and I think context is always important with the stuff that we are really in a very unusual period where everything seemingly is desynced, right, internally. And I see that across stocks and bonds. I see that across sectors. And obviously, you know, you can make the case there with commodities, with oil in particular, the way that you framed it in terms of the last 10 years versus the last 2 years in terms of the number of regime shifts, the last 2 years matching the last 10. Now, I've heard you talk about this idea that really what we're in is more of a refining crisis than anything else. I want you to talk about what you mean by that. What is the link between refining and oil prices? Because everyone that's investing sees a chart. They think they understand oil, but they don't understand the mechanics of what results in the price of oil beyond the standard supply and demand. But there's more to it than that. So talk about the refining side and why that's been such a problem area for this cycle.
Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah, I completely forgot to mention that in that kind of little intro there. And what's particularly interesting here right now is not only are we in a refining crisis, but we're also in an inflationary crisis. And central banks have overwhelmingly focused increasingly on headline inflation rather than their typical focus on core, which obviously excludes food and energy, et cetera. And the main reason they're doing that and the main reason they've pivoted their focus is because the main concern of central banks now is this potential for an unmooring of inflation expectations among kind of, you know, everyday citizens. And the single most volatile kind of obvious price signal to those people is the price of the pump. It's what everyone sees. It's on every billboard as you're driving down the highway. So now everyone's focused on, you know, the price of the pump even more than the price of oil. And just to kind of put in perspective how acute the situation we're currently facing in the refining side, and it has eased a little bit, but at the peak of how tight it was, you know, the 3-2-1 crack spread, which is, you know, a very, you know, rough hand kind of indicator that kind of blends, you know, two barrels of gasoline and a barrel of diesel into, you know, a blended refining margin for kind of refiners. And the, you know, in normal times, that spread is somewhere in the ballpark of $15 to $20 a barrel, you know, 20, maybe 25 if it's, you know, it's a really, really good year for refining. And that's usually mostly because of strong demand or a bunch of refinery outages or whatever. Now, you know, at the peak, that hit $60, almost $70 a barrel. So when you and I were looking at the price of WTI on the screen and we're seeing, you know, $120 a barrel for WTI or crude oil, however you measure it, and then you kind of go to the, you know, you go to fill your tank of the family car, you're actually paying closer to the equivalent of $180 a barrel because of that inflamed crack spread, you know, three, you know, upwards of four times what it normally would be. So the reason that's really important is now there's this kind of focus on that, you know, very, very headline, you know, even beyond oil, it's, you know, what is the price of the pump? So what's been happening with the refining crisis? And I'm going to split into kind of three big themes here, one of which is structural, one of which is kind of geopolitical, and one of which is just a policy choice. So on the structural side, this is, you know, when COVID came along, I described this in one of the pieces on commoditycontext.com. I encourage everyone to go check it out. The thesis I kind of rolled out was this idea of a collapsed bridge. And refining is a very, very slow moving sector, even more slow moving than crude oil on the upstream side, just because of how big, complicated, massively long lead times these facilities take. And refining has also been kind of a crap business for a very, very long time. The majority of the time that I've been in the industry, it's been low profits, kind of low excitement. Everyone was generally looking, particularly in the West, to kind of slowly phase down capacity and hand the baton, if you will, to the new ultra sophisticated refineries coming online in the Middle East, in Asia, in China and India. And there's also another major facility that's supposed to be coming online in Nigeria. So all of these are supposed to be coming online. And then they're going to put even further competition on those, you know, further pressure on crack spreads, further competition for Western refineries. For many of these refineries in the West, they are exceptionally old facilities. There, you know, there's a facility that we've all been watching in Houston that's over 100 years old, just to kind of put in perspective how old and kind of creaky some of this infrastructure is. So then COVID comes along and obviously completely obliterates demand for road fuels, jet fuel, et cetera, et cetera. Those crack spreads are obliterated. And what you see is any of those Western refineries that had been, you know, considering, you know, the next couple of years they're going to shut down, they decided to do it all at once. They were like, well, we're not going to fight to stay alive. for maybe another 18 months before we were already going to close. So that basically, those retirements spiked well beyond anything anyone had expected. OPEC's annual report had expected about 300,000 barrels a day of refinery retirements or closures in 2020 and 2021. We actually got more like 2.3 million barrels a day of closures. So, you know, 7-8 times what the expectation was. And the other thing, all those refineries that were supposed to be coming online during that period also got pushed out, because anyone that was looking to start a refinery, well, like, this is not the best time to start a refinery. And they also had a bunch of the supply chain and labor and other COVID disruption stories that kind of affected all the rest of the global supply chain. So you had a spike in retirements. You pushed back a lot of the capacity that was supposed to be coming online, and you opened up this kind of, you know, big gap in the middle. So that's a structural component. And that, you know, and I know transitory has become a dirty word, but it is inherently transitory, because all of those, you know, refineries that had been pushed back are still on the books. They're, you know, they're right near completion. They'll be coming online this year and next. So that's I think, part of the reason why this refining crisis is going to be relatively short-lived. But then the other two parts.
And by the way, I will say real quick, I will say that the parallel to me is sawmills when it came to lumber prices.
Totally.
Right? So sawmills were never really an issue in terms of getting lumber out there for home construction until COVID hit. Sawmills suddenly became the bottleneck, right? Because all the trees and the wood that would go into the sawmills to create the lumber was still there and accessible, but it was the processing that was the problem.
Exactly. And then what added further weight to this, obviously, in anything commodities and anything oil this year, there's a China component. There's also a Russia component. The China component is, you know, blending with this net zero kind of strategy and direction of a lot of Chinese policy right now. Part of what they want to do, and I mentioned earlier that refineries are not the most desirable assets to have in the West. They are often, you know, people joke that they're kind of preordained EPA Superfund sites, you know, highly polluting, different, you know, it's not always the asset you want. Beijing agrees in many ways, and they want to eliminate road fuels from their export mix entirely by 2025. So they had already started reducing the allowable volume of exports from China of, you know, diesel and gasoline and jet fuel. And that had fallen by about 50% relative to this time last year. So that's, you know, another chunk, maybe 500,000 to 700,000 barrels of additional capacity, functional capacity loss there. And also finally on the Russia side, what's interesting is that everyone's focused on the crude side for Russia, but the first area where that self-sanctioning actually began to bite at Russian industry was actually on the, I'll call it the semi-refined products. So Russian refineries, for the most part, aren't as sophisticated as the refineries we find in, you know, the United States. Quite often, what they will do is they will partially refine crude oil into these intermediate goods like vacuum gas oil or residual fuel oil, and then export those products to then be further refined and reformed into gasoline and diesel in the United States and Europe and elsewhere. It was those products that were actually first kind of suffered the self-sanctioning blockage. And because of that, Russian refining capacity or throughput fell by about 1 million barrels a day in March. And that was ahead of the losses we saw in crude oil. So that was the first kind of chain that allowed those sanctions to kind of work through the physical flows. So those all together drained a good chunk of what had always been ample refining capacity. Again, refining capacity for a long time had mostly kind of been almost like a tolling infrastructure system. Like, it really wasn't that exciting. So now it's very, very exciting, and everyone's focused on it. Governments are overly concerned about it. But the challenge is, you know, while I think there's a lot you can do on, you know, the crude side, and I think, you know, after this refining crisis yields off, I think then we shift back to a crude oil crisis. But there isn't a ton that governments can do on the refining side in the near term, aside from, you know, maybe, you know, at the margin, maybe loosening sanctions on Venezuela. So you can get some of that, you know, semi-refined product that you had been getting from Russia had they been getting it from Venezuela before the sanctions, or maybe more pressure on Beijing to loosen up some of those export restrictions. But I think it's mainly a timing factor. You know, the storm will pass, but then we're left with this chronic kind of longer lasting issue, which is, where are we going to get the crude oil we need, particularly if U.S. shale producers are not going to grow at the pace that we're used to them growing? They'll still grow faster than virtually any other jurisdiction on the planet. But if you're used to the United States growing by 2 million barrels a day per year, like it did in 2018, and it's only growing by 1 million barrels a day now, that's a big change. And that, I think, is the kind of longer lasting structural function of the situation we find ourselves in.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Okay, so I think this is interesting in the context of the way that things have played out this year, because as I'm hearing you, it makes it sound to me like, yes, there's a longer-term secular argument for oil itself because of underinvestment, supply, where you can get it from, and that's going to cause sort of this drift push higher in price. The surge that we've experienced that goes into everything that the media talks about seems like it's much more driven by the refinery side than suddenly a dramatic spike in demand. And if that's the case, then if oil is a signal for inflation expectations, it's a distorted signal because of the refinery crisis.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I do think, like, even before the refining crisis kicked in, you know, crude had already was at the point of almost reaching $100 a barrel on a Brent basis before Russia invaded Ukraine. But then when Russia invaded Ukraine, again, it put all of those systems that were really on like the knife's edge of kind of balance fully over into kind of crisis territory. And if you look at the crude side, but also the product side, inventories are extremely low, particularly outside of China, which is facilitated, even though I think, you know, what, you know, as an example, I think that demand has been reasonably strong for much of the past 18 months, but then began to weaken, you know, at the most notable pace since the beginning of the pandemic, you know, this spring, because of China's varied COVID zero policies and an attempt to lock down on that system. And just to give in perspective, you know, Chinese demand, by my measurement, fell by something like 3 million barrels a day between like February and April, which is a very large kind of chunk of loss in that period of time. And again, this goes back to that conversation about how, you know, people always say that, you know, volatility like this can't be justified. You know, it has to be speculators. It has to be, you know, something that's jerking us around well beyond fundamentals. But my point is that we've never seen fundamentals this volatile. So if prices weren't similarly volatile, that would also be very strange. So I think what we're seeing right now is a system that is used to moving very, very slowly, and maybe people get cute around the price trading. But now I think the fundamentals are a bit cute and kind of changing so frequently that people are having to adjust their expectations and kind of their view on the market much, much faster than they ever had before.
And that would explain the confusion around the last, you know, several weeks of price action as well, right? Because the fundamentals are volatile. Now the price is extraordinarily volatile. And it's not just in oil. I've noted to advisors that I talked to that when you look at wheat, soybeans, corn on the ag side, you've taken out the entire war premium. They've gone a round trip from when Russia went into Ukraine, and the prices are basically back at pre-war levels. And you can look at commodities like copper, and you see a very similar dynamic where there's a very serious about face. If oil is sort of the king of commodities from that perspective, then this sell-off, if it's because of, for whatever reason, a reassessment of the refining crisis or because of fears of recession, it does make it hard for people to have a sense of what comes next, right? Because to your point, when you have action that's that aggressive, you can easily make it the case that it's a correction and then you still go higher, or it's a crash and you go way lower.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to kind of look at some of the other major indicators that I watched. Like during that, what is that? I guess two Tuesdays ago was the big, more than a $10 barrel a day drop. I think it was the third largest intraday route in the oil market's history. Like big, big moves. When you look at the way crude traded on that day, it was essentially a complete and perfect parallel downshift in the curve, which, for some people, it's a really, really bad sign. I know someone, WTI Realist, is actually in the audience, had pointed out that a lot of equity research associates will just plug the curve directly into these models, And so on an equity basis, a sell-off like this is really, really bad. But for me, watching the commodity itself, when you trade the entire curve parallel down like that, you've essentially preserved all the tightness in the calendar spreads or, you know, the term spreads, effectively the steepness of the backwardation, the futures curve. So what's interesting is, you know, you actually, on that day, actually believe many of the parts of the futures curve actually tightened slightly, which is a very opposite indicator to obviously what the flat price or the kind of price of the prompt contract is doing. And what you saw, you know, by the end of that week, because we got data from the CFTC, the commitment to traders report, ICE also produces one as well. And you saw that net positioning of so-called speculative actors in the market, this is the managed money component for the people that follow the data, that fell on a net basis from already a fairly kind of middling level. It wasn't high by any means and may have actually been pretty low. But the worry with that data is that it can always go lower. And what we saw was that position has fallen to its lowest level since April 2020, when crude was temporarily negative, or at least on a longer term basis, kind of trading in the teens. So we now, if you think about the price, you know, if there's a fair price of crude that's determined by a whole bunch of different variables, but then speculative activity will kind of push it slightly above or slightly below whatever that fair value is. We're at the lowest deviation to the downside since the very beginning of the pandemic. So the way I read that is, if we get something that fundamentally tightens the market again, let's say China comes back out of, you know, rolling quarantines or whatever else causes it, when that price starts moving up again, and when that starts to tick all the right algorithmic boxes or discretionary boxes or whatever, there's a lot of money on the sidelines that had been associated with kind of pumping up crude. And I think that would just bring us higher faster on whatever that next move is up.
Okay, so that's interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, the idea here is that the current price of oil is, let's call it, quote unquote, fair value, whatever you want to, however you want to define fair value.
Sure, yeah.
It's ex-speculators. Yeah, I always make this point that you really get a sense of what the real price of something is by taking out speculators and just look at the hedgers, right? That's where you kind of identify what real price is. But if that's the case, and then you have this potential tsunami of speculators re-entering, then that sounds like a setup for something much more severe that could still be coming, but maybe not in at a pace like everyone's concerned about, where you'd have a super spike, right? Because it goes back to your argument about oil from a secular, longer-term perspective. There's a lot of money that can be made there, but once you've kind of resolved the refining crisis over time, then you've got more of a steady uptrend as opposed to a volatile one, if that makes some sense.
I should be clear that I'm not a trader. So, you know, to the degree that, you know, I think we could I think we likely will get volatile spikes to the upside again. I don't think that they'll necessarily be kind of persistent or lasting, but I do think that, you know, if we started trading up on a fundamental basis on that kind of longer term trend again, I do think that we will get volatile, you know, melt ups as well. I think particularly as people start talking, you know, people start seeing inventories drop to, you know, fresh all time low numbers, you know, the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve and other, you know, strategic petroleum reserves continue to drain. You've seen the comments about, you know, from Saudi Arabia this past weekend and the President Biden's trip there, and people are really over fixating on various parts of that conversation. But I think like all the recipe is there for a very, very strong kind of melt up if this is to kind of resume an upward trajectory again. But I think at this stage, while oil still has all of this fundamental truth to it, it is also kind of, as everyone knows, you know, a very, very, you know, like you said, king of commodities, you know, in many cases, kind of king of risk on assets, and it's a macro asset. So in a recessionary environment like we find ourselves right now, particularly fear of a recessionary environment, an asset like crude contracts are going to kind of feel the brunt of that, as well as the kind of equities associated with them. But I don't think, you know, even if we fall into a recession, unless it's, you know, a truly deleterious kind of depression level event, really what that does is it doesn't usually even contract demand on a global basis. It usually just slows the pace of demand growth. So rather than 1.5 million barrels a day, kind of on a steady state growth, maybe you'll get 0.5 or 0.7. So it'll allow supply more time to catch up. But after you re-accelerate demand again, you're back in that issue of, well, OPEC's tapped out for the most part, shale's growing slower, really outside of you know, OPEC in the United States, you've got where I'm at, which is Canada. You get some incremental growth from the Canadian oil sands. You'll get some growth from Brazilian offshore, and you'll get some growth from Guyanese offshore, which is the major kind of new find that we're growing out right now globally. But other than that, not much crude left, particularly when you're thinking about some of the longer term issues with Russian supply. That's where it becomes more of a chronic issue. And when you have seen, I mean, despite all of this, you know, the curve, the back of the curve in particular, remains relatively low. So whether, you know, it's always the next piece I'm working on right now is actually trying to provide some kind of thought out context to how to think about different parts of the curve. And I became really obsessed with looking at the 5-year forward WTI or Brent price. And that price is still trading at $65 a barrel or so, up materially from that kind of 2014 to 2020 period, but still good $20, $30 a barrel lower than the period that we found ourselves in out of the global financial crisis, which was near kind of 95 to 100. So if that's the price that producers care about, particularly the price that their equities are valued on, then that I think is going to be a challenge when you're trying to send the signal that we do truly need more investment to break this kind of capital discipline issue that's you know, predominantly driving a good chunk of investment in the shale patch. And just to kind of bring it back again to central banks, when you hear about, you know, the Fed or other central banks wanting to tighten policy to slow demand growth so that supply can catch up, that's great in theory, but the challenge is that that can also have supply effects. And if my main point had always been that in this particular cycle, it will not be the price of oil, but the price of the producer equities that finally gives those, you know, the U.S. shale patch license to drill and grow again. That's only at that stage will the investors that stuck around through all of the downturn finally say, sure, you know, you've earned the right to grow, figure out how to do it in the best way. But when many of those producers are down, you know, 25, 35, 40% because of the financial rout that by all intents and purposes was like caused by the policy tightening, well, that's going to be a problem if you want supply and demand to come into balance.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
So you mentioned the great financial crisis, and I kind of teased that for this space, you know, is oil sort of doing the playbook of 2008 where commodities went vertical up until the start of the second half of 2008 and then really started breaking down. And that's sort of the classic pattern you see when you have fear of a recession, you know, looming, right? The commodities very suddenly then do an about face and start collapsing. Do you think that the sell-off in oil and commodities in general, is that on fear of recession, or is this more akin to just sort of a correction within a secular bullish asset class? Because I think this is the real dilemma. To your point about everything's moving so quickly, everyone's looking at oil as a signal for the economy. And it is a signal that has a lot of merit historically because oil tends to correlate very highly to break-evens, to inflation expectations. So how do you interpret this most recent sell-off in terms of the longer term and in terms of recession or no recession?
I think two things. So first, I think that this is largely pricing in recession fears rather than a deflating of a spec bubble of some kind. And the reason I say that is that I had mentioned earlier that normally when you see big, huge melt-ups in crude prices in particular, and I think this is true of a lot of commodities, but I just know crude best, so I'll kind of stick there. Like what you saw in March and April with the kind of big wild swings in prices associated with Russia, normally you would think that's speculators. But what you've seen over the course of the data is that open interest, you know, largely, like overwhelmingly, has fallen considerably, both on a net, like an overall basis, but particularly in a speculative basis, because the volatility and the kind of margin required for these contracts was so much higher. So you could, I mean, I'm still working through exactly how I want to kind of think about that. But I think it removes the possibility that prices were overwhelmingly kind of pushed up by this flood of money coming in. Because actually, there was less money going into futures contracts than prior to the Russia invasion. Juxtaposing with 2008, I think that was much more of, you know, there was a lot of spec froth and really everything. And that was because everything kind of moved in this very, it was a steep upward kind of trajectory, but it was kind of unidirectional. Whereas what we've seen over the past 3-4 months in crude has been a wild kind of $50 worth trading range, kind of jumping back and forth at a rapid pace, which to me is less about spec influence and more about, again, this kind of wild repricing of constantly majorly shifting fundamentals, both in the supply and demand side. If we come out of this, and let's say we don't have a recession, and let's say that central banks stop, you know, moving policy around, and we start going on this kind of, oh, okay, now we'll focus on these longer term structural issues, and you start getting banks releasing reports about kind of a longer term kind of $200-$300 barrel crude, like that was the classic in the 08 crisis was Goldman's $300-$400 crude call. I think all that together, you know, that is when I think that you'd start getting this flood of money in. And that's when I think you would start to risk one of these kind of speculative bubbles to the upside. But again, I think for commodities, you know, eventually you're always going to need to re-anchor to physical reality at some point. And in this case, that typically is going to mean inventory. So inventories are very, very low. So I think that's part of the reason that even when, on my calculations, the market moved into my, you know, oversupply in April and May of this year, we didn't see a collapse in the calendar spreads that would have been associated with that kind of move. And I think that's largely because even if the supply-demand balance has kind of shifted, inventory levels are still so low that everyone's still trying to buy back inventory where they can. So I think that's the challenge we're facing right now.
Okay, Rory, you, in the beginning you had said that there's various parts of this move that you think the popular narrative gets wrong. I want you to go through some of the things that you see that you know outright are just false, that people seemingly are very adamant on as far as a talking point about oil. And what is it that you think people are underappreciating about oil market dynamics here?
All right, so let's go with the first one, which is always a fun question. I think the thing that people most consistently get wrong, particularly if you're coming from a financial-only perspective, fixed income or equities or whatever, is what the shape of the curve means. I think for a lot of people, when the curve is in contango, particularly as steep a contango, backwardation as we see today, which means the curve, you know, the prompt prices are higher and the curve is downward sloping in the future. People will say, and I used to work at a bank, we used to work with risk committees, and everyone kind of had this view that that's the quote market forecast of what prices are going to do over the future. Kind of like, the yield curve or something where it's, you know, there's a lot of kind of movement trying to price in expectations. I think that, you know, it's probably not fair to say there's no forecast component in crude oil. And I think I've been working on this kind of longer dating anchoring of the curve, I think there might be some of it there. But I think that's the lowest kind of portion of the curve's signal. And I think what the curve is really telling us is essentially what the kind of incremental momentum is in inventory management. So if oil markets are oversupplied, that crude needs to go somewhere, which means into inventory, and the market needs to pay for those people to hold the inventory, which means discounting the front of the curve and allowing them basically to initiate a carry trade and hold that over X amount of months and basically profit for free as long as they can store it, right? That's the contango. For someone looking at that curve, they say, oh, that's bullish because the price is going up and to the right. But in reality, it's actually, it's basically showing a current oversupply. And if you just, the best forecast typically is to take the current state and just roll it to the next period forward. That's what we usually see with crude oil, that periods of contango or backwardation are sticky and kind of persistent to a degree. So when you look at the history of the last, let's say, 25 years of oil, the curve has been backwardated, or theoretically, the quote, the market's forecasting it to go down for all of the tightest periods of the oil market, and vice versa on the other side, like when oil dropped to negative $30 a barrel or whatever in April of 2020, that was a super contangoed market where basically people were paying any amount of money for you to take crude off your hands. Now you're seeing, you know, $10, $20 a barrel premium to hold, you know, to release a barrel of crude from inventory today and get that exact same barrel back in a year. It's actually the opposite. You know, there's no carry cost. It's an opportunity cost. So if you can part ways with your crude, you're printing money here. But no, that's the thing. Inventory draws have kind of stopped because people still need operating kind of room for these inventories. So I think that's the thing I think that is most misunderstood in the market. And what was your other question? Sorry.
Well, just what do you think that people are underappreciating when it comes to the oil market now that people don't talk about, but you think is an important point to focus on?
Yeah, and I think this is just this question of, you know, how much has changed through the pandemic, particularly regarding U.S. supply growth. I think a lot of people that are in this space constantly, I think this is, you know, old hat, you know, this is an obvious, well-known factor. But I think for a lot of other people, they assume, oh, okay, after things go back to normal, shale will go back to that prior, we call it the shale band, that anything under $40, it shrank, anything over $60, it grew. But right now, you know, you hear people like Scott Sheffield of Pioneer, et cetera, that are saying, hey, you know, it doesn't matter if crude's at $300 a barrel. We're not growing investment by more than 5% a year, which is a very, very different environment. I think that it's always risky to say that this will persist indefinitely because the oil market is definitely, if the only thing you can count on is it's going to constantly kind of change around. But I do think that a lot of these producers are probably telling the truth on price, which is why I kind of moved to that equity kind of trigger of. I think the only thing that's going to get these companies really investing again is going to be a re-rating of their company value to a stage that it seems worthwhile to deploy capital for growth rather than share buybacks and debt retirement. If you look at the kind of major three basins, Bakken, Eagle Ford, and Permian is definitely by far the largest of the basins and where most of the incremental growth is going to be coming from. And actually, in my latest piece that Michael has so kindly posted up at the top of this space, I even break it down a little bit further. What you've seen is even within the various plays within the Permian, part of what makes the Permian unique is that it's so deep and multi-layered, and you can kind of come at it in so many different directions. So the Wolfcamp, which is the traditional kind of engine of Permian growth, is actually more or less kind of plateaued a little bit right now. And what we've seen is basically in the fall back in 2020, we're still a bit shy, still a bit down from that kind of pre-pandemic peak for the Wolfcamp. Whereas Spraberry and Bone Spring, which are these other plays in the Permian, have, you know, exploded, and you've seen much more growth out of those. Meanwhile, Bakken is still down something like 400,000 barrels a day from pre-COVID levels. And then Eagle Ford is not only down 200,000 barrels a day from pre-COVID levels, but it's actually down about 500,000 barrels a day from its previous peak, which is, you know, the Eagle Ford actually hit a high back around 2015, 2016. So the Eagle Ford is actually really, really slow right now. And same with the rest of the other basins. To your question about how much longer, you know, U.S. can grow, I need to do more work on this in terms of getting a really developed view as to basically what the Permian's ultimate recoverable kind of volume is. But I do think that if you're growing at a kind of more modest pace of, let's say, 1 million barrels a day or less, I do think we've got, you know, a couple more years, five probably at least, of kind of significant kind of growth where the U.S. will be, you know, the largest incremental producing growth in the world. And I think it's also easy to forget that that's not an especially high bar anymore, right? If the U.S. is going to grow by 500,000 or 600,000 barrels a day, it'll still be the biggest source of growth. That's part of my point, is there really isn't that many big areas of growth left. And then to your final question around offshore, I dug really deep into offshore for this past piece that Michael has posted up at the top. But what you're seeing there is actually, so you're still down about, I think, 150,000 barrels a day from pre-COVID levels. But you're having three major new projects come on stream this year. And I think there's a lot of excitement about the offshore, both offshore Canada and Canada's East Coast and Newfoundland and Labrador, but also I think particularly in the U.S. Gulf Coast for a couple of reasons. One, costs have come down a lot. A lot of these projects are claiming to be break even in $40 to $50 a barrel, whereas historically the cost base has been much higher. And the comparison between a lot of other productive upstream methods, offshore, because of the reservoir pressure, actually has relatively low upstream emissions. So when companies are looking to green their overall emissions intensity of their production profile, getting heavier into offshore is actually a really attractive way to do that right now. So I think that I think that we're going to see a really exciting period over the next couple of years in offshore. And I think concentrated in some of those areas that have, you know, traditional infrastructure and experience, which obviously puts the Gulf of Mexico high on the list. So just to put a couple things into perspective. So OPEC Plus's deal. So OPEC Plus, I've claimed many times, saved the global oil market. And we would actually have much higher prices today if OPEC didn't cut production by nine, or OPEC Plus didn't cut production by 9.7 million barrels a day in April of 2020. That really rescued the market. Otherwise, price would have needed to stay much lower for much longer, which probably would have meant shale would not have declined to, you know, 11 million. It probably would have, you know, declined into the single digit millions and lower, because that was how the market theoretically was going to balance. So you saved a lot of productive capacity with that cut. Now you're in the process of returning that cut for basically the entirety since that initial cut took place. And that is meant, you know, all of it's supposed to roll off by the end of the summer now. And that's been accelerated. It was initially going to be September, October. So the question is, what happens with OPEC Plus next? Many of the producers within OPEC, the dominant kind of bulk of them, really have no productive capacity left to offer to the market. You know, the focus has been over the last couple of months has been lack of, you know, hitting quotas, particularly with some legacy OPEC members, most notably Angola and Nigeria, which are each kind of 400,000 to 500,000 barrels a day below their quotas. That, you know, I don't think there's going to be a lot of upside from those jurisdictions. Where you do see some, spare capacity, and this is a, I would say, one of the most fraught topics in all of kind of FinTwit and the oil side, is how much can Saudi Arabia really produce? They claim production capacity of 12 million barrels a day, give or take. And the comment around growing their production capacity, and again, this has been something that's been really misreported over the past couple of days, is the plan is to increase production capacity, not production itself, but capacity to 13 million barrels a day over the next 5 years. Now, first, that's great. We're going to need more oil. But when people think about that, you know, a million barrels a day is a big number. That, again, is what we're expecting the U.S. to grow each and every year in actual production, not just capacity. So it's actually not a huge factor in terms of near-term or even like half-decade balances. But again, we're going to need it, so that's good. The general view is that between Saudi and UAE, maybe you hold 2 million barrels a day of initial spare capacity, maybe. And I think after that, we're going to need that. The market has never really been without a spare capacity cushion. So the question is, how will the market react when, you know, there's a belief that there's no capacity left? We don't really know. But I think it seems unlikely that the result is going to be a bearish function of oil prices. I think all else equal, it should be a pretty bullish development, which is why I don't think that OPEC production capacity really is as important as it used to be. The question is, where is the incremental growth going to come from? Which brings us back to shale. And I really don't think that no countries in OPEC can grow as quickly as shale can. Again, we're talking Saudi Arabia, kingpin of OPEC, is going to take 5 years to grow by, you know, a million barrels a day. So I'm not overly concerned that I think, you know, the discussions around how people are going to kind of, you know, open a flood of OPEC crude to the market. I don't think that's going to happen. It always can. I mean, again, never say never in oil, but I don't see it happening. I think that what we've seen over the kind of decade prior to COVID was a low energy price environment, reasonably low volatility environment. I think it was the perfect kind of environment for people to feel very, very cozy in the reality that we were going to have this nice, easy transition towards a net zero economy in the future. And I think what COVID proved is that was a very naive assumption. And my hope is that now we see, you know, it's more complicated than just the upstream emissions intensity of a barrel of oil. You also have to look at the reliability of that barrel, the kind of overall kind of political and human rights background of the producer. Now, for some people, this is very old hat. People have been talking about, you know, Canada's, you know, quote, ethical oil for a long time. But it's been very easy to ignore those arguments because, well, we didn't need it, or at least people didn't think we needed it. And I think the other thing that's going to be stickier here, I think actually in some cases, the political reality could move faster than the investment policy reality. And one of the things that's really interesting is that for the last, again, the decade prior to COVID, if you were sitting at a, you know, an institutional manager or a pension fund or whatever, and someone was kind of showing you different return profiles, well, it was really easy to put around restrictions on extractives and oil and gas, et cetera, and, or go with these kind of ESG, you know, tilted indices, because they actually outperformed the overall market because, you know, returns in oil and gas and mining have been terrible for a very, very long time. It's going to be much harder. I think it's easier to change those in the first place than it is to backtrack on them later. So I think if this environment persists, we will eventually see that again, hopefully. But I think in the near term, the reality is there's less of a pool of capital. I don't see it so much in terms of debt financing, because I think particularly now with prices, a lot of these people can fund it out of cash flow if they wanted to. I think the issue is the investable universe of capital that could allow the equity values of these companies to be higher, which again will be, in my mind, the biggest signal to grow production. That, I think, is this short circuit. So I think that it's one of these rare moments where even among progressive politicians, I think we've seen a very notable about face in how they talk about oil, how they talk about energy. Like you were saying, a lot of these re-ratings in Europe of gas and nuclear, but you know, Germany's still not seeming to turn around on its nuclear kind of phase out. So it's complicated. My hope is that the crisis doesn't need to last too long before you know, cooler heads and kind of more modest heads prevail in terms of strategy. But that's the hopeful perspective in this. The nice thing about, you know, the COVID era is we have a huge wealth of alternative high frequency data that we never had before. So I think all of these metrics of, you know, we can track real-time flights, we can track real-time shipping, we can track real-time, auto congestion in various cities. That'll help tremendously. But I'm a purist. I like good, verifiable, kind of redundant data from various sources. So I'm mostly, for the most part, looking backwards about a month or two for when we can actually get official data from multiple sources to corroborate. And I think, so there's a lot of focus. There will always be a lot of focus on forecasting, but I think there's not always enough focus on, you know, now casting correctly to figure out where we are today from which to forecast. So that's currently where most of my focus is right now. And again, looking back at, you know, this past April, we saw the largest oversupply in the market, about 3 million barrels a day or so by my count, the highest oversupply since the initial rout in oil in March and April of 2020. That, however, was predominantly driven by China and surrounding East Asian economies. My expectation is that that will normalize. Now, maybe it'll normalize just in time for Europe to go into a recession or, you know, whatever else is going to happen. But to me, it seems like we're close enough to balance on a kind of a multi-month moving average basis. And inventories are so low that we would need to be in a pronounced oversupply period for a long period of time for the market to really, you know, feel comfortable and for operators to feel comfortable in their inventory position. And I just don't see that happening in the near term. Again, unless we get, and I'm sure there are plenty of people that see like an outright depression coming down the line here. I'm not one of them. I think that we might get, you know, an easing of growth, a kind of a slowdown. But a global recession to me still feels, a global like depression level event still feels unlikely. But again, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's all macro and, you know, eventually. And I think that that will drive kind of the final balance if we do get kind of a full collapse in demand. It is really confusing because dry gas production is not down as much as shale oil production, but it's nowhere near as high a level of growth as we've seen in NGLs. And there's two things that are happening simultaneously. One is that you have seen a build out of fractionation capacity, so more capacity to push that gas through facilities that can extract the liquids. And particularly if you break down within NGLs, and these are natural gas liquids for anyone else that is interested, you can break it down into like the five big buckets. And really, both butane, isobutane, and C5 or pentanes plus is all still reasonably flat-ish, you know, not dissimilar to what we see in the dry gas outlook. But really where you're seeing the spike is ethane and propane. And a large part of that is, again, there's more liquids heavy gas in terms of the makeup of that dry gas coming from the Permian, but also there's more fractionation capacity to draw it out and more demand sink for it in the form of petrochemical facilities around the U.S. Gulf Coast and really, really strong export demand. So the incentive to, you know, with ethane, there's always the option to reject the ethane and keep it in the natural gas, you know, stream. And that's what's really been changing. So I really encourage you. I actually just tweeted just before the space started a kind of breakdown of the four big bucket charts. And one of those is actually on NGL. So I really encourage you to take a look at that and check out the piece I posted, because I also, it was confusing, but it's really, really interesting to dig into. And I'm going to do a lot more work on NGLs in the future. My only kind of preface to this is that I'm not an equities focused person. So I'm mostly focused on the commodity, but I will just add some thoughts here, which is a couple things. And this is going back to that comment I had a little bit earlier about the kind of parallel shift downward in the curve. One of the things that that's unique about this moment is, even if we're seeing 120 crude on the ticker, the curve is so backwarded. And this is what I'm going to be writing my next piece about, is how to think about the longer day portion of the curve, what signals are kind of expressed in which portion of the curve, et cetera. It's actually probably not that far off what a lot of these stocks are discounting on, let's say, five-year average kind of forward blended average basis. But I think the other thing here is that there is two things. One, this point about this kind of policy change at the institutional management level that have reduced the overall kind of universe of funds that could be invested in these companies. And if you're just a kind of a classic kind of, monetarist almost, just, you know, there's less cash chasing the same number or even more equity. So that's part of it. But I think the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people aren't super familiar with these equities anymore. I think the majority of the people that kind of, you know, a lot of people stuck with those companies way through the downturn, made a lot of money off the bottom. But now people that are getting in, let's say, at the beginning of this year, well, the volatility is so extreme, I think it's very alienating to a lot of people. So I do think that when you see risk off moves like this, and people just kind of hold this general knowledge that, oh, okay, well, in a recessionary environment, risk assets and commodities are going to get absolutely crushed. So might as well bail on them early. So I do think that, you know, stocks were starting to actually discount, if you will, reasonably high crude values as of the end of May, beginning of June. But everything has come down 30, 40% since that point, which it goes back to this question that it sucks for people that held those equities today, but it also is better, quote, from, you know, more bullish from the perspective of future demand, supply demand balances. Because again, that for me was the only thing that was finally going to give license to these producers to finally increase volume. And now that, you know, I made a joke on, you know, two Tuesdays ago when the price was collapsing, that like, I picture there being, a debate going on in like, shale company X in their head office, you know, we're going to grow, you know, look at, you know, read this, you know, Substack, you know, everything's so bullish. We should be growing. And then basically, you know, the intern scampers in and says, oh, you know, sir, the WTI is down $12 a barrel today. And they just throw the growth guy out the window. They think it's, you know, it takes a while to build up the confidence that this is sticky. And then given the volatility, the floor falls out. And I think that's just it's one of the least conducive environments I can imagine to incentivize growth. And I think on the supply side. So I think that's this challenge we're in now. So it's going to be very, very volatile, but I just see the structural supply demand balance getting more and more kind of bullish or deficit-y over the coming years, unless something really breaks in a major way. And I think at this stage, it's more likely that demand breaks than supply starts growing faster again. But I think the hope is in a couple of years, the market will start to rebalance and shale will start growing. And that's essentially how we're going to get not the worst possible transition we can imagine, but I think that's the best we can hope for at this stage.
Everybody, please make sure you follow Rory Johnson. Check out commoditycontext.com. Rory, first time you and I are chatting. I appreciate the flexibility, given that I had to reschedule yesterday for today. But thank you for joining us here, and everybody enjoy the rest of your weekend. Thank you, everybody.
Have a great weekend, everyone.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.